I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jack Pod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So we are at episode 28 this week. What's your headline?
How to steal a presidential election.
Okay, so this is something that's been written about quite thoroughly. We've talked about it a lot on the show. So what do you have that's new for us, Jack?
Well, I want to talk about what's happening, what people can expect might happen at the polling stations and inside the polling stations, and then shift the focus to voting certification boards, what might happen there. So to begin with, even before we get to the polls, right as we speak, there are voter challenges going on all over the country. Voters are being challenged. 1,000 voters were challenged by one person in a Michigan town. There's a group called Pig Pen Project in Nevada that is targeting groups of voters and saying these people aren't legitimate voters. Check into it. There's something called Souls to Polls in Michigan, which is targeting groups of voters challenging their right to vote. And all this leads to litigation and investigation and a climate of intimidation and fear. So that's even before we get to Election Day. What to expect on Election Day? If I may, here's an anecdote. Before Election Day 2022 up here in New Hampshire, a local Proud Boy group announced that it was going to send people to the polls and that they would be watching what happened. It wasn't in our town, but it was near enough. And my wife and I really seriously debated, well, do we really want to expose ourselves to that? The point is, even committed voters can pause a moment at the thought of some, 300-pound lout pushing you around as you go in to vote. A spokeswoman for the Trump campaign recently said, we are going to send, quote, soldiers to the polls. In Michigan last year, Trump urged his supporters to, quote, guard the polls in Detroit, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. And, of course, those are heavily Democratic, heavily minority cities. Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP, called that comment dangerous and reminiscent of the kind of threats the Ku Klux Klan used to make against voters in the South. And Trump said in New Hampshire, he said, you got to get out there and watch those voters. You don't have to vote yourself. We got plenty of votes. We want you to keep your eyes on these people. It takes no strenuous effort of the imagination to imagine, Trumpist people at the polls standing outside saying, why are you voting? Why are you voting? Who are you? And, you know, we say, well, that can't happen. It used to happen all the time. William Rehnquist, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he made his beans in Arizona challenging minority voters as they walked in to vote. So we can expect trouble outside the polls. We can expect inside the polls that poll workers will create their own kind of trouble. The Trump campaign, RNC, has a training for people to be poll workers in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Atlanta, essentially to be within the polling area and to challenge voters there. And they are wired through, they got their cell phones, to lawyers who can give them legal palaver to challenge voters. Mm. So people are going to have a gauntlet. They're going into the polls, there's almost certainly to be something going on. Inside the polling station, you're not safe to vote yet because Trump people are going to be poll workers. And there was a recording of a GOP operative, this is before the last election, 2022, saying, being a poll worker, you just have so many more rights to stop someone voting. And all of this will be known ahead of time and will serve, one, to intimidate people from voting, and once they're in there, to make it, for some of them, to make it harder to vote. We don't have to scratch our heads to imagine the voters who will be challenged. They will be overwhelmingly African-American, because the chances that they are Democrats are very high. So that takes care of the scenario outside the polling station, inside the polling station. Then there's another place where trouble could arise, and that is at the county level, at the meetings of voting certification boards. And this has a historical precedent.
On November 22nd of the year 2000, weeks after the presidential election that year, we still did not know who had won Florida and who had therefore won the presidency. Over 10,000 ballots remained to be counted by the Miami-Dade Elections Board. When Republican operatives, who the Bush campaign had flown in from around the country, heard that that count in Miami was going to go forward, the count of those 10,000-plus remaining ballots, those GOP operatives decided they would physically shut down that count.
So that was Rachel Maddow, right, Jack, on her MSNBC show in 2010. But she was talking about what happened in the year 2000. In 2010, the biggest thing I can remember is Obamacare.
Right, right. No. Yes, she was talking about the famous Brooks Brothers riot, as it was called. And what happened was Republican operatives, I think none of them were from Dade County, showed up outside the area where they were counting the ballots and ready to certify them, and made so much of a ruckus that the counting and the certification was stopped in its tracks. And it later came out that almost everybody there were a big crowd of them, had some connection to staff of Republicans in Congress. So the point is, we can expect that to happen again. Rolling Stone has done some really important reporting on 15 instances in 8 states since 2020 where Republican officials have refused to certify elections. This has happened in, look at the states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, New Mexico. And their reason for not certifying elections was, citing conspiracy theories about the voting machines or other, Trump canards about voting. And part of the strategy is to create chaos and to create, a false basis for trying to find a way to challenge the outcome of elections. People worry what's going to happen as these boards meet. The point is, it's happened 15 times since 2020, as recently as November 2023 in Colorado, and those are rehearsals for what we can expect probably at the county level in 2024. So people are warning, looking back at the Brooks Brothers riot, saying we can anticipate something like this happening at scattered vote certification centers, especially in these swing states. The Brennan Center warns about it. And the other thing is, the people that are on these boards are known, and they will have threats against their lives almost certainly. We've had tests of it since 2020. It's happened 15 times. It will happen for sure with election deniers on these boards in 2024.
You know, Jack, you're getting at something which I think is perhaps the point that makes all of this very chillingly realistic, right? And that is that Donald Trump has, very plainly and vocally advocated for political violence in the past, right? I mean, we even have this example here that you pointed to. It's Trump at a campaign rally in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. This was back in the 2016 election in February of 2016.
The security guys, we have wonderful security guys. They said, "Mr. Trump, there may be somebody with tomatoes in the audience. So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise.
So he said it overtly before. Then, of course, we had January 6th after that, several years later. Is that the thing that you think, Jack, makes all of these what would otherwise be perhaps rightfully criticized as fantastical concerns, it actually makes them real concerns?
It makes them overwhelmingly real. Real, what's the Holmesian phrase, real and present dangers. Trump's distinction in the whole of American political history is that his movement depends on and is energized by the threat of political violence. And in that clip from Iowa in 2016, before the first votes of that primary had even been counted, Trump was laying down what remains his permission slip for violence. He's saying to those people, go ahead and kick the crap out of somebody and I'll pay the legal bills. Impunity. Don't worry. I'll pay the legal bills. He's saying the same thing now to voters when he talks about January 6th, I'm going to pardon the people who tried to overthrow the government on my behalf in 2020. And if, by implication, I'll pardon you if you're violent at a polling place, if you're violent at a vote counting center, if you create trouble. Don't worry. The fix is in. I'll pay your legal bills, or once elected, I'll pardon you. That's sending a message.
Mm. Okay, so here's what I want to know from Jackpod listeners for this week. And that's basically the scenario that Jack has laid out, and quite frankly, that other political scientists have also laid out regarding how an election, a presidential election, can be stolen with the cooperation of people sitting in, you know, key positions in this country and at the federal and state level. Do you think it's realistic? Do you think it could happen in the United States? So let us know. You know how to do it, right? Because I'm sure you already have the On Point Vox Pop app on your phone. If you're one of those few who doesn't, go to the to wherever you get your podcasts and look for On Point Vox Pop, because that is how we love to hear from our ever-growing family of Jackpod listeners. And we want to welcome many, many more people into the family. So looking forward to hear your thoughts on if you think that it is realistic to imagine that the presidential election can be stolen in 2024. Okay, Jack, so the reason why I want even more people to come into our circle of Jackpotters is we're going to come back in a second to listen to what they had to say about last week's pod. But many people, after they listen to you, they come away with this feeling.
I just want to say thank you to Jack for making me feel like I am not completely losing my mind.
So either people feel more sane when they listen to you, Jack, or I hate to say it, it's possible we're all living in the Matrix together. We will find out. We'll find out in just a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, Jack, we're back. And just as a quick reminder, last week on the Jackpod, you talked about missing misery, or the real facts of life that are not built into how inflation is calculated in this country, and how without those facts or those considerations, the inflation numbers, even as they purportedly are getting better in the eyes of federal level economists, are not necessarily getting better in the lives of real people. And we got a ton of messages about this, Jack. So let's start with Brittany Braden in Louisville, Kentucky.
It seems like every time I listen to something on inflation, I am reminded of how wonderful things are. And while it is true that my husband and I have a middle-class income and we continue to make more and more every year, it's also true that we can afford less and less. And I'm not talking about vacations or new homes. I'm talking about groceries. We can afford less groceries now than we could a few years ago, despite making more money.
What Brittany is talking about there, Jack, is clearly a diminishment in the quality of life that even regardless of income. We got lots more messages on this exact point. So here's another one. This is Sarah Hamm from Nacogdoches, Texas, with a similar story. She says she and her husband are comfortable and they own their own house. They've got a really low mortgage rate right now, but they are looking to relocate and cannot afford a home with current mortgage rates. And here's the thing. They also can't afford, quote unquote, extras like vacations.
I feel very discouraged that like my life here will only be working and just being in the same house and not really being able to do any of the extras. And we work hard, we have degrees, and we just can't seem to be able to get out of the current pay bracket that we're in. And quite honestly, if any medical catastrophe happened or one of us lost our jobs, we would become uncomfortable quite quickly. And I feel very discouraged about my future, and I'm only in my mid-30s.
So that's Sarah in Texas. And Jack, it is so heartbreaking to hear people, I mean, to tell us their true situations right now. We're supposed to be having the American dream of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that pursuit of happiness part seems to be dimming with each passing year for so many people.
Yes, and the phrase middle class, which used to connote, you know, a kind of father knows best, life of Riley, security, it doesn't mean that at all. And the fear of falling can't be underestimated. It haunts American politics because people see how quickly it could happen. That medical emergency that Sarah talked about can quickly drop you to the bottom or near the bottom. There's no security. There's nothing to hold on to stop the fall. The welfare state has not seen to the general welfare. People know that, and that has all kinds of the fear of falling has just its role in Trumpianism can't be denied or blinked at either. And you know, Brittany's point about groceries, I checked it. Under Biden, they're up 21%, eggs up 37%. And you know, if you leave out the pandemic, which essentially put the last year of Trump put a line through that, real median income went up under Trump, and it has either fallen or been flat under Biden. A question was recently asked in a Brookings poll to non-college educated voters, which party brings prosperity? And you know, up until the Reagan era, that was the Democratic Party, right? The party of working people. By 60-some-odd%, the non-college educated voters say the Republicans bring prosperity. Only a third say the Democrats.
Mm. Okay, we've got more, Jack. This is Joe Shadler in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I am a person who is adverse to borrowing money by credit or by mortgage, or any other ways of living beyond my means. Your show expressed how the price of borrowing money is not being caught in the inflation rate. And to me, that is a symptom of a larger problem in America of excessive comfort with borrowing and living beyond one's means.
Okay, Jack, so I definitely want to hear you on this, but I just had a quick response of my own, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And that is, you know, philosophically, I completely agree with Joe. I mean, I grew up in a household where the daily mantra was spend less than you earn. So again, philosophically, I think Joe's spot on. But realistically, I mean, look, you just talked about real income. The truth is that people aren't earning enough money to be able to afford things like homes and cars without loans. So
that's right.
So it's like, yeah, you can criticize people for taking loans and living beyond their means. But at the same time, I'm sorry, in modern American life, in many, many places in this country, you actually have to have a car in order to function, right? As a worker, as a family member, to get around in your community. So I think the disconnect between the realities of how much money you need to have to even just have like sort of a minimal standard of living versus how much people are earning kind of renders Joe's philosophy there a little bit moot, even though, you know, my heart's with him, Jack. And that shrinking that disconnect, I think, is something that must be done. Otherwise, just more and more people are going to get sucked into this black hole of not being able to afford a decent kind of life.
Yes. And he, you know, he talks about living beyond one's means. Well, that's the American way. I mean, you know, credit and borrowing, the whole notion of who can afford to buy a house with cash? I mean, that he's presupposing a status. I'm glad that he enjoys it, but that so few Americans can pay cash for houses, can pay cash for cars. Everything has to be, you know, borrowed. And shocking numbers of people use their credit cards just even to eat, mm-hmm. to pay for the groceries. And, you know, you can say, well, you should live within your means. But there's a wonderful passage, I don't have it here, I had it at one time, of Adam Smith's, where he says, you know, yes, in absolute terms, a laborer doesn't need a linen shirt. He can work in a different kind of shirt. But any self-respecting laborer wants to be seen in a linen shirt, because if he doesn't have one on, people will think he's a wastrel, that he lives at the, you know, in the demimonde, that he's a criminal and or can't get his life together. And that sign of is a sign really of his character. He needs that linen shirt as a signifier. Well, we all need the linen shirt as signifiers, the car, the house. Take those things away, And our sense of our own importance is diminished, because our status is diminished.
Yeah, you know, I to support Joe a little bit here again. Philosophically, I'm with him. Maybe people don't need a flat panel TV in every single room of the house, right? Like excessive frivolity, totally get it. Don't max out your credit card for that kind of thing, but this word means, right, Jack? I just want to say one more thing about it, because again, you just said, in real terms, people's incomes have gone down. Over the past several decades, we've had this long-term wage stagnation. So in real terms, people's means have gone down, even though they're doing the same, if not more work in terms of productivity. And that gap is what people are forced to turn to credit for. And it's not sustainable, Joe. I'll agree with you on that. But I don't think I'd necessarily blame people for being, totally frivolous in their spending. But let's go to Tom Brassard. He's in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he thinks, actually, Jack, that you left out a really important factor.
While listening to your Missing Misery jackpot, I kept waiting for mention of what I believe is the elephant in the room on this topic, and that is corporate pricing and, in some cases, greed. No media outlet that relies on advertisers and donors appears to be willing to touch this contributor to inflation and also the widening income gap.
Tom, to correct the record, we talk about shareholder primacy a lot here on this show. I guess that's an overly complicated way of saying the shareholders get to make money while the workers don't. But Jack, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I did leave that out. And Tom is right. And, you know, I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown in Congress, Senate, they have both spoken of how the inflation crisis has been used by big companies to take it as an opportunity to keep their prices higher than normal. In other words, a kind of inflation premium. People expect inflation, we'll give them a little price inflation. And that it's essentially put a new floor, a little mm-hmm. higher, under what companies can charge. And they've cited, the oil companies, I think, have been cited when gas prices were so high, that was a target. And, of course, the oil companies say, well, we have to recoup money that we that we lost in fallow years. Who knew they had fallow years? But this idea that somehow, well, yeah, we are charging more, but we need to make up for the years when things weren't so good. So yes, corporate pricing is a big issue. And, you know, this whole, you could say, what could Biden have done that he didn't do? Well, what did Nixon do? He implemented wage and price controls so that corporations couldn't hike their prices and unions couldn't demand more money, and essentially try to freeze the inflation. It didn't work, but the point is it showed that Nixon was willing to do anything to stop inflation. Did we get that from Biden? No.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tom, maybe if you haven't heard it, it's okay. But if you go to the On Point podcast feed, which I guess you're already in it because you listen to the Jackpod, on June 2nd, 2023, Tom, we did a show that was literally headlined Greedflation, or Why Corporations Are Keeping Their Prices High, even though the pandemic and supply chain issues have pretty much gone away. So if you can't find it in the podcast feed, go to onpointradio.org and look for Greedflation, because this is exactly what we were talking about on that day. Okay, Jack, so there's one more here. We got a call from someone or a comment from someone who actually says you were wrong about the way you talked about inflation. So this is Kyler Farr from North Bend, Washington. He is a CPA.
The whole reason the Federal Reserve raises interest rates and thus increases the interest we all pay on debt, and whether it's credit cards, car loans, or mortgages, is to decrease the demand for those things and then cool off the economy, at which point rates go back down. To include those as a measure in inflation is just mixing the pot incorrectly.
Okay, Jack, what do you think about that?
My point was, and again, I got my economics degree from Walmart. I mean, what do I know? I'm citing no less than Larry Summers and his colleagues at Harvard, who in this paper for the National Bureau of Economic Research say that, you know, inflation used to include the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, used to include the cost of money. Exactly what our gentleman thinks we left out, though that shouldn't be part of it. I'm saying that right up until 1983, that was a standard measure. It isn't now. If it were back into the CPI, inflation would have been not at its height 9%, it would have been 18%. And maybe we would have had wage and price controls. Who knows? But I take his point that I don't know what I'm talking about inflation, but I assume Larry Summers does.
Yeah. Well, actually, Kyler, would love to hear your response, because, you know, we actually kind of enjoy the back and forth that we have here on the Jackpot with listeners, because I actually see the point that Kyler is making, because monetary policy is something that the Fed just thinks about and can make changes on. And if I remember correctly from our conversation last week, Jack, we discovered that one of the reasons why that 1983 change in the CPI was made was to, in fact, take or reduce the volatility in the CPI that was coming with keeping in the cost of money. Okay, so that might be what Kyler's referring to in terms of mixing the pot incorrectly. But again, this is where I come back to economists and charts say one thing, but as we've heard from all these other listeners, how we live our real lives, if it doesn't have that much in common with the numbers that policymakers are using to make policies that impact our real lives, then what good are those numbers? So, Kyler, let us know. Send us a message with an answer to those questions. And with that, Jack, that's it for this week. What another week. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the Jackpod from On Point.